welcome Ms. Welch to the podium.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court, Sarah Welch for the appellant, Dante Small. Mr. Small presses a single claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. He argues that he rejected a favorable plea offer because his attorney failed to correctly advise him of the 40-year mandatory minimum sentence he risked and ultimately received after going to trial. That single claim has two possible remedies at this stage. First, the existing record already supports one remedy, requiring the state to release Mr. Small or reoffer the already documented 20-year plea offer. Second, the other remedy is a remand for an evidentiary hearing to allow Mr. Small for the first time to submit evidence in support of his allegations, including that there was an earlier 10-year offer. Section 2254 does not bar either remedy. The state court screened Mr. Small's claim as frivolous because it concluded that the key transcript passage was irreconcilable with Mr. Small's allegations. That was an unreasonable determination of the facts because the claim and the transcript are readily reconcilable. In fact, the transcript passage documents the 20-year offer and reflects Mr. Small's attorney's incorrect understanding of Mr. Small's sentencing exposure.
Now, Small's habeas petition argued that he would have accepted the state's offer for a 10-year deal, but it doesn't make mention of a 20-year deal. If we find that it was an unreasonable determination of the facts, that Small understood his sentencing exposure to be 40 years, does the fact that Small only referenced a 10-year deal but not a 20-year deal preclude relief?
No, Your Honor. The state's lead argument is procedural default, so I'm certainly happy to start there. Mr. Small has always asked, including in his initial pro se filing in the post-conviction relief proceedings, for relief on the existing record or an evidentiary hearing to allow him to continue developing his claims. The existing record documents that 20-year offer. In addition, the question that the court faces when it comes to procedural default is whether the petitioner is asserting the same claims that he fairly presented to the state court. And the court defines the same claims as whether they involve the same operative facts and the same controlling law. Every court to look at this claim has recognized that April 27th transcript passage is the key transcript passage to consider this claim. So that's the same operative facts have always been involved. And the same controlling law has always been involved. This has always been a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to correctly advise Mr. Small of that mandatory minimum sentence. So we do think that Mr. Small has been constantly pressing the same claim and even seeking exactly the same forms of relief on that claim throughout his proceedings, even when he was pro se before the state post-conviction courts.
Before you move on, how much of his sentence has Mr. Small served to date?
I believe it's been about 14 years.
Okay. Thank you.
The state also presses a forfeiture argument in connection with its issue preservation arguments. And as to forfeiture, the court has acknowledged that litigants have the right to refine their claims on appeal to continue developing them. Before the district court on page ID 110 in Mr. Small's habeas petition, he did request again relief on the existing record or relief via an evidentiary hearing to allow him for the first time present evidence in support of his claims. So again, Mr. Small has developed those claims further with the assistance of counsel once the court appointed counsel to represent Mr. Small, but that's well within the norm for what a pro se litigant is permitted to do in refining his arguments on appeal. I'd like to turn to deference to the state court's findings under Section 2254D, as that's cross-cutting between both remedies that we request and was really the basis for the district court's resolution of Mr. Small's claim. The state court rejected Mr. Small's claim based on its unreasonable determination of the facts in concluding that the key transcript passage was just irreconcilable with Mr. Small's allegations. In the state court's language on page A75 of our appendix, the state court said that the transcript completely contradicted Mr. Small's claims. In other words, it just logically couldn't be squared with Mr. Small's allegations. That's not the case. At absolute minimum, the transcript doesn't rebut Mr. Small's allegation that he was never advised that he hadn't that he faced mandatory consecutive sentences for a true mandatory minimum that he ultimately received 40 years as opposed to the 20 years that the attorneys and the 21 years that the court discussed on that transcript. And we don't take the state to argue otherwise on that. They instead argue that the that either Mr. Small didn't really care about the possibility of consecutive sentencing or that there wasn't really a mandatory consecutive sentence requirement. As to the first argument, the record just rebuts that. We've cited a number of places where Mr. Small raised the issue of mandatory consecutive sentencing. And just from a common sense perspective, it was a difference of 20 years, of a requirement of 20 years, and that would, of course, matter to anybody. And as to the second argument that the consecutive sentences weren't really mandatory, the state's argument on that point is that they were mandatory only if the state court, the state trial judge, made a finding that Mr. Small had inflicted severe bodily injury on his victim. Even if that finding...
Yes. Let me ask you this. You know, the state court focused its attention on the colloquy. And in that colloquy, the prosecutor indicated that an offer of 20 years had been given on the primary charge. A few minutes later, the prosecutor stated, that's the minimum, okay? Is there any way that Small could have known that he faced a minimum 20-year sentence on each attempted murder charge due to the prosecutor noting on the primary charge?
My reading of the transcript, Your Honor, is that the comment about the primary charge was reflecting that the 20-year offer was a charge bargain, so the state would dismiss the remaining charges, there were two other charges, and would accept Mr. Small's plea of guilty on only the primary charge. So I think that's what that comment was about. I don't think that the transcript reflects that.
I'm very confused by that whole colloquy. I have to say that straight out. I mean, we'll talk to Mr. Wood's attorney, but.
Sure, Your Honor. I do think that the colloquy coming up specifically in the context of Curry admonishments, the court's question of whether Curry admonishments were necessary also reflects Mr. Small's attorney's lack of understanding of the total sentencing exposure that Mr. Small faced, because Curry admonishments speak to the entire sentencing exposure of a defendant. Those were the facts of Curry itself, where the defendant faced mandatory consecutive sentences if he was convicted of multiple counts. And Curry admonishments, the court found in Curry that defendant had received ineffective assistance of counsel because he hadn't been instructed about the possibility of mandatory consecutive sentencing. And so Curry admonishments arose to prevent that in the future by making sure that a defendant is told on the record of the mandatory, the total possible mandatory sentence that he could receive if everything goes against him at trial. And so that context, we think, particularly cuts in favor of Mr. Small's arguments and against the state court's findings. I'll turn briefly to Mr. Small's argument for an evidentiary hearing to allow him to develop the basis for his arguments. Section 2254E2 permits evidentiary hearings in state habeas proceedings if a petitioner has diligently pursued his claims and his request for an evidentiary hearing throughout the state court proceedings. This court also applies a pre-2254 standard, and we've briefed that in our opening brief, and the state hasn't made any argument in its brief that Mr. Small doesn't meet that standard, so I'll address only Section 2254 standard. Mr. Small has been diligently asking for an evidentiary hearing since he first raised this claim in post-conviction proceedings. That first request is on page A99 of our appendix. That's been enough in a number of this court's cases, for example, Davis, Jones, Lee, Avila, and Ward. And the state rests on the point that Mr. Small didn't attach affidavits of potential witnesses to his post-conviction review petition. He did attach his own affidavit, and he would be presenting his own testimony, most likely, in an evidentiary hearing. So he did provide verification, as his attorneys argued, to the state courts. The state courts never found that that was procedurally deficient, and instead just noted the argument and then proceeded to resolve Mr. Small's arguments on the merits. And in addition, Illinois law requires either affidavits or an explanation of why affidavits aren't attached. Mr. Small had requested two extensions that the court didn't rule on prior to the deadline for filing his petition. And in those extensions, he explained that he had affidavits to support his claims, but they had been taken from him by the prison when he was released from segregation. And he documented that by attaching a grievance to his post-conviction review petition.
Are we to take anything that in all the time since then, he hasn't reproduced the affidavits?
There's never been an opportunity for him to produce those affidavits, so the court ruled on his petition without asking him to supplement or allowing him to supplement, just screened it out as frivolous, and then he was never able to present that on appeal, of course, because it wasn't part of the record, and then he couldn't attach it to his initial 2254 filing in the court below because the court would need to grant an evidentiary.
Is there anything in the record that tells us who these mystery affidavits were from?
I believe on page A98 of the appendix, he says that his attorney had consulted with him and his family. So that's likely what the affidavits would be about. And his habeas petition just contains these allegations about his attorney's advice being 6 to 30 years, the existence of the 10-year offer, and his attorney's failure to tell him about the mandatory consecutive sentencing exposure that he faced. The court has any other questions, I'm happy to answer those, or I'm happy to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, Ms. Welch. All right, we will now hear from Mr. Malamuth, and please correct my pronunciation when you approach.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Eldad Malamuth on behalf of Respondent. This court should affirm the denial of habeas relief and the denial of an evidentiary hearing. And the reason for both is that Section 2254D2 prevents either from occurring. And that is because the state appellate court did not make an unreasonable factual determination in this case. Now,
may I stop you? Because one sentence in the colloquy between Small's counsel, the prosecutor, and the court about the need for a Curry admonishment advised Mr. Small that he could face consecutive sentences. Did the colloquy ever mention the words consecutive or concurrent?
No, Your Honor. So the colloquy, the factual determinations relevant from the colloquy are twofold. One, that that there was no 10-year plea offer made. And that's actually the key allegation in this case that has been relied on by the state trial court and the state appellate court and the district court. The second is that is petitioner's claim that he was unaware that he believed that he faced a sentence as low as 6 years under the primary charge. And those two things are distinctly contradicted by the colloquy, and that is what was relied on by the state appellate court, the state trial court, and the district court. And the colloquy clearly contradicts those factual assertions made by petitioner. So petitioner asserted,
how do they do that? It's such a confusing colloquy.
Well, Your Honor, the colloquy proceeds like this. The judge asks if the Curry admonishments are necessary. So that is to say whether an offer was made below the minimum that the court needs to admonish the petitioner about, or the defendant at that point, before proceeding to trial. Now, everyone agrees that the minimum sentence on the primary charge is 20 years. Everyone agrees that no offer was made below the minimum. Now, just as a matter of logic, if there's no offer made below the minimum, there's no offer made below 20. That's so there's no 10-year offer made. So that's the issue of the 10-year offer. Second, petitioner asserts that had asserted that he was unaware that the minimum sentence was not 6 years. Well, in this colloquy, everyone agrees, with petitioner present, that the minimum is 20 years. And so if the petitioner is aware at this point of the minimum sentence not being 6 years, this contradicts his assertion that he was unaware of that. And petitioner, in fact, really concedes this. His argument is more that he might have been unaware at some previous points, and there might be some other explanation of why he didn't object to the 20-year minimum that was put forward and agreed to by everyone. But that does not change the fact that it conflicts with his knowledge, and that the state courts were reasonable in finding that to be the case. And that is particularly true because the petitioner, it was his burden to set forth in the petition or attach affidavits or record evidence which would support his claims.
The prosecutor says, I think the minimum was 20. We did make an offer of 20. And his defense counsel says, you did? I mean, he doesn't even seem to know that.
Well, they agree, Your Honor, that the 20 years is not below the minimum. And if you look, as the colloquy continues, defense counsel specifically states, this is on page A63, so appendix 63, as the colloquy continues, they are discussing, so the offer was 20, yes, on the primary charge, exactly, okay, and the defense counsel says, which has been rejected.
Okay, so here's the thing. The poor guy is standing there, right? Nobody says to him, do you know what's going on here? First, his attorney says, you did? He doesn't know that 20 years has been offered. And then he says, later on, the defense counsel says, which has been rejected? I mean, if this isn't confusing, or maybe I'm just a confused person, I'm terribly confused by all of this. I can't even imagine what Mr. Small must have been thinking, what's going on here? And no one says, Mr. Small, do you know what happened here? You know, help me, someone.
Well, Your Honor, as an aside, Mr. Small was consistently vocal during these hearings. He, for instance, specifically asked to speak against the advice of counsel and asked for a speedy trial, even though his counsel had told him not to. I mean, he's complaining about the counsel at various points, so there's no particular reason to think that, you know, Mr. Small wouldn't have voiced disputes, if he had one, with the colloquy. But in any event, the key here is...
The state court is relying exclusively on the colloquy related to the need for a Curry admonishment. But nothing in the exchange notifies the defendant that his sentences could run consecutively and that in reality he is facing a minimum of 40 years.
Well, Your Honor, the colloquy doesn't reflect whether petitioner's counsel informed him that the sentences could run consecutively or not. The colloquy doesn't address the issue of the potential of consecutive sentences. And as a legal matter, that was right. I mean, consecutive sentences weren't mandatory. Now, if he had raised a claim and to the extent he argues that he hadn't been told that his sentences could run consecutively, that particular factual allegation is not contradicted by this colloquy. But the question is whether the factual determination that the state courts made was unreasonable, whether it was an extreme malfunction of the judicial system for them to base this, their determination, on this colloquy. Well,
that really depends on how you're asking the question. If we find that he consistently has pressed the issue that he was misinformed or underinformed about his sentencing exposure, at that level of abstraction, if we find that, do you agree that the colloquy we have been discussing does not inform him of his sentencing exposure in terms of the fact that he could get consecutive sentences, the fact that that minimum is actually 40?
Well,
in other words, does your argument only work if you ask us to construe his argument in the way, the very way the state court did, which is to be one specifically about, I thought the min was 6. I thought there was a 10-year plea deal, as opposed to a broader question of, I have been misinformed. I am trying to tell the courts I have been misinformed.
So, Your Honor, to step back for a second, the state court was faced with petitioner's claim. Petitioner claimed, I turned down a 10-year plea offer, and I did so because I was unaware. I believed that my sentence, the minimum sentence, was 6 years. And by the way, also, I was never informed that my sentences might run consecutively or had to run consecutively, as he phrased it. And the state court looked at this claim and said, the record before us contradicts your claim, your assertion that there's a 10-year plea offer. And by the way, it also rejects your claim, it contradicts your claim that you weren't aware that the sentence was below, that you believed that you faced a minimum of a 6-year sentence. And based on those findings, we reject your claim. Now, petitioner has to come here under 2254 and say, that was unreasonable. That was, no fair-minded jurist could reach that conclusion. And the avenue that, and petitioner even acknowledges that to get to the issue of whether or not the consecutive sentences might entitle him to relief, you have to find that the factual determinations that there was no 10-year plea, and that the that he wasn't aware that his minimum sentence was 20 years have to be unreasonable. So they have to make those determinations. We have to say these factual determinations were unreasonable, and we have to do so before we can proceed in any other way in the case. And when Judge Rovner, you say that they was just basing on this colloquy, but once again, that's part of the problem is because petitioner did not provide any affidavits or any evidence to suggest otherwise. Now, he raises this assertion that he did not have, that these affidavits had gone missing after he had gone to segregation in prison. But first of all, even the the documents he provided indicate that he had signed a document stating that he had been returned, that he had received all his materials back. But in any event, he also had 3 months after he filed the petition, approximately 3 months, to supplement the petition with affidavits before the court ruled. He had weeks after he returned from this incident before he mailed out his petition. He also had the opportunity to explain who these affidavits would be from, what they would say. He didn't do any of those things. And under Illinois law, he was required to do so. And just a quick point about that, petitioner asserts that somehow the state appellate court disclaimed this requirement as a basis for its decision, but that's not right. So in the Post-Conviction Hearing Act in Illinois has two distinct requirements. One is that there, under 122-1 of the Act, there's a verification. This is a pleading requirement that all the allegations are brought, you know, truthfully and in good faith. And a separate requirement that the petitioner attach affidavits that show that his allegations can be corroborated independently. And what the state appellate court said, and petitioner had just provided one affidavit, and the question was, well, whether this could count as both. And the state appellate court said, we're going to assume without deciding that just sort of as a minimum pleading requirement, this is sufficient. But then it immediately goes on to say, however, under 122-2, petitioner has provided no supporting records on which his allegations could be corroborated. And so all that we're left is with this colloquy. And again, so the state court has turned down a 10-year, the claim that there's been this 10-year plea offer based on these two factual determinations. The claim that he would reject a 20-year offer has never been made. He never asserted that he would accept a 20-year offer. And so that operative fact was not before the state appellate court. And so the state appellate court, so that's defaulted and can't form a basis for habeas relief.
If we disagree with you and we determine there is no procedural bar or EDPA bar to us reaching Smollett's claims, do you agree an evidentiary hearing is appropriate as opposed to the outright relief that Mr. Small is requesting?
Well, no, because it's still 2254 D2 still would bar the evidentiary hearing because there was no unreasonable determination made on the 10-year plea offer, and that's the basis of the denial of relief in the state court. And also, because under 2254 E2, petitioner was not diligent. Petitioner claims that there are all these cases in which just requesting an evidentiary hearing is sufficient, but that's not true. So very quickly, in Lee, there were multiple affidavits provided to the court, and in Davis versus Lambert, there were there were several descriptions of what witnesses would testify to, who the witnesses would be, what they would testify to. Petitioner did not make that showing, and so he wasn't diligent in developing the factual record in state court. So I see my time is up. Unless the court has any further questions, we would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mahmood. All right, Ms. Welch, we welcome you back for your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of points in response. I'd like to begin with what I take to be the warden's consistent acknowledgement that, as Mr. Malamud said just now, that particular allegation referring to the fact that the colloquy doesn't discuss consecutive sentences isn't contradicted by this colloquy. And because the state court's rejection of Mr. Small's claim as frivolous relied on the idea that the colloquy did contradict that allegation in Mr. Small's petition, I don't understand how there could be Section 2254 D1 deference to that conceitedly unreasonable determination of the facts, that there was a contradiction between the colloquy and Mr. Small's allegation that he was just never told of the exposure that he faced to mandatory consecutive sentences. I'd also like to address Mr. Small's diligence. First, to Mr. Malamud's discussion of whether the state court relied on the lack of affidavits from other witnesses attached to Mr. Small's post-conviction petition. The state court did disclaim that as a basis for its decision on pages 14 and 15 of its decision. It said, assuming without deciding that Mr. Small's 122.1 affidavit, which he did attach, was sufficient, it rejected the claim as completely contradicted by the record. As to Davis, which strongly supports our argument that Mr. Small was diligent because the petitioner didn't attach affidavits there, it's true that Mr. Davis did describe in more detail than Mr. Small what the witnesses would have said. That was necessary for his claim because his ineffective assistance claim in Davis was that counsel was deficient for not having called those witnesses. So it would have been impossible for him to make that claim without describing what the witnesses that his attorney didn't present would have said, and that was necessary for his deficient performance argument. Finally, just to go back to Mr. Small's allegation that there was a 10-year offer, the warden continues to argue that the record contradicts the idea that a 10-year offer was ever made. The fact that there was a discussion of the 20-year offer, we know there was a 20-year offer, doesn't mean that there was never an earlier offer. It's certainly possible that Mr. Small could present evidence that would establish that there was an earlier 10-year offer. And supporting the idea that that is consistent with the plea colloquy, the record reflects that there was a different prosecutor during that colloquy versus in previous discussions with Mr. Small on the record. And Mr. Small's attorney, as Judge Rovner noted, wasn't aware that there had been any offers in the case, so he was not going to be able to say on the record exactly what the history of plea negotiations had been. So we'd ask the court to rule for Mr. Small. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Welch. And we see that you were appointed to represent Mr. Small. You have our thanks and the thanks of the court for accepting the court appointment. We will take the case under advisement.